Good morning and welcome back to hour number two, the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls this morning is Jason Croft. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about Turkey and the politics in Turkey, particularly looking at the issue of nationalism in Turkey today. And our guest for the program is Halil Baktay. He is Associate Professor of History with the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at Sabancı University in Turkey. Currently, he is spending some time here in the United States at the Center for Middle East Studies at Harvard University. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, and we're pleased that he could be here with us spending some time today. Going back to the beginning of the year in January, you may recall the murder of a Turkish-Armenian journalist, a man named Hrant Dink. He was murdered outside of his office in Istanbul, and he was someone who was well-known as an outspoken advocate for Turkey's Armenian community. He had been targeted, among other things, for talking about the Armenian genocide by the Turkish government that took place during World War I. In this part of the program, we'll try to talk a little bit about that, but about what that says about Turkish nationalism, and perhaps also talk about current politics in Turkey with our guest. Questions as we do that are welcome, as always. The number 333-9455, that's the number for folks who are listening here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Perhaps also I should mention, too, that his visit here to the U of I campus is sponsored by the folks at the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. Well, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Hrant Dink. Who was he?
Among other things, he was a close friend of mine and a frequent visitor at our house. And we talked and thought and exchanged ideas about many, many things. We had been at many conferences, seminars, panels together. He was somewhat younger than me, in his early 50s. A Turkish-Armenian in a very profound sense, in a very complex sense. After his death, he was described as an Armenian who happened to be a Turkish citizen. This is the sense that you get from many things that were said and written about him, but he was more profoundly a Turkish-Armenian hybrid than that. It was not just the citizenship. He was a rare cultural, intellectual hybrid in that he could be, and he was actually, in terms of his emotions, in terms of his intellect, in terms of his line of thinking. He was not just Armenian under a formal legal Turkish aegis, but he was profoundly, internally, both Turkish and Armenian. And as a result, he was able to build bridges and have constant dialogue as well as critical exchanges with both Turks and Armenians, Turkish nationalists and Armenian nationalists. He was capable of advocating recognition of the historical tragedy that had befallen the Armenians, the extermination and annihilation of the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire in 1915. He could call it genocide. He could advocate a genuine recognition as the sine qua non of reconciliation and the healing of wounds. At the same time, he could be very, very critical of Turkish nationalism, as all this implied. He could also be very critical of Armenian nationalism, especially as it is manifested in some sections of the Armenian diaspora in the United States. He could be very, very critical of genocide recognition politics, as it is commonly practiced. That is to say, this whole business of just trying to bring pressure on Turkey from the outside to force recognition of the 1915 genocide externally on the Turkish state. He could be very, very critical of that as counterproductive and as making things more difficult inside Turkey and so on and so forth. But as a result, he had enormous credibility. Precisely because of this mestizo, this hybrid, this métissage kind of identity, and his profound universalism, and the fact that he was an advocate not just for an Armenian cause, narrowly understood, but much more generally for a comprehensive and profound democratization of Turkish society. He regarded recognition of the Armenian genocide not as a precondition of that, but as a necessary and inevitable dimension and also as an offshoot. He tried to, just as he was trying, not by himself, myself and many other Turkish intellectuals and scholars were involved in this, just as he was trying to explain and argue with the Turkish establishment or Turkish nationalist circles, that Turkey could not possibly be a normal, sane and democratic society without acknowledging the real historicity of the Armenian genocide. He was also trying to explain to various Armenian diasporas abroad the fundamental objective had to be the democratization of Turkish society and not just genocide recognition by itself. And, of course, on the way to building up this position, and this basically all happened over this past decade, up till the year 2000, there was hardly any talk of the historical reality of the Armenian genocide inside Turkey itself. In the late 80s and early 90s, the very first Turkish scholars to begin writing and producing a certain scholarly and very serious output on the Armenian genocide were all outside Turkey. People like Professor Taner Akçam, who was at Hamburg at that time doing his PhD. People like Professor Fikret Adaner, who was at Bochum in Germany for a long time. They became the pioneers in beginning to talk about this. They became the first Turks, the first Turkish scholars to break through what has been called a wall of silence. But eventually, from 2000 onwards, what happened was Turkish scholars and intellectuals and academics inside Turkey, too, started coming out of the closet, so to speak, to say openly to the Turkish public, and not just in relatively marginal scholarly works of small circulation, but in the mainstream press, in the daily press, to say, yes, this was an enormity. Yes, this was an incredible component of the ethnic cleansings and atrocities and massacres that attended nation building in Turkey, the formation of the Turkish nation state, and that this has got to be historically recognized. And, of course, all hell broke loose. There were campaigns of intimidation, large amounts of hate mail, obscenities, death threats, and so on and so forth, for example, directed at me. When I became pretty much the first established Turkish academic inside Turkey in October 2000 to make my position very, very clear in the daily press, in the large circulation daily press. And when others spoke up, there were also campaigns organized to have us fired by our respective universities, Sabancı University is a private university that has been funded and endowed by the Sabancı family and Sabancı Holding in Turkey. And at various points, there were even attempts to engineer boycotts of all Sabancı Holding produced goods and merchandise until Sabancı University agreed to fire me from the history faculty. But in any case, from 2000 onwards, it was a more and more high-profile struggle to break down the long-enduring taboos of Turkish nationalist mythology in this regard. And it was in that context that Hrant and I, for example, met and came to know each other and became very close friends. Now, as I've said, throughout this turbulent, tumultuous decade, Hrant was really never a narrow partisan of a narrow Armenian cause, as understood. What I think most irritated Turkish nationalists about him was precisely his maturity and his capacity of speaking critically to both sides and of building bridges. Perhaps it was because of this that he was perceived as, in the long run, very dangerous, because he was the one person capable of drawing together critically minded, universalistic and humanistic Turks and Armenians. Not, you know, he was not into the business of building a general Armenian case against all Turks. Instead, he was a very key member of a group of critical dissenting intellectuals who were gradually building bridges of this kind. And instead of genocide recognition politics as narrowly understood, trying to build a common constituency of both critical Turks and critical Armenians in a common cause for the building of a deep democracy in Turkey, part of which would again be genocide recognition. Mm-hmm. So I would say that perhaps it was his credibility and his maturity that rendered him most dangerous in the eyes of Turkish nationalists. Beyond that also, he was, in some sense, an easy target for hate-filled Turkish extreme nationalists, precisely because he was Armenian. Ironically, what made him increasingly a target for attempts at repression was a series of articles that he wrote satirizing Armenian nationalism. In early 2006, I think, in the weekly newspaper periodical Agos, which he had created and of which he was the owner, manager, editor-in-chief, the heart and soul. He wrote a series of editorials about Armenian nationalism in Armenia, severely critical, and trying to point out the extent to which it was so very like, in many respects, a mirror image of Turkish nationalism. In writing those editorials, he quoted a famous speech by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk out of context. There is a famous speech by Atatürk in which Atatürk calls upon Turkish youth to rise up against all odds in defense of Turkish independence and sovereignty, and he says, even if you are all alone in the world, all the power and resources you need are the noble blood in your veins. Hrant took this, twisted it around, and wrote to addressing Armenian nationalism in Armenia. He said something about all the force and support that you need for this poisoned nationalism is the poisoned blood flowing in your veins. The point being, this is very difficult to translate into English, but the point being that they were just as much ethnic and blood nationalists as Turkish nationalists. Hmm. You know, this was what he was trying to push in. But this was perceived, this was construed in the very statist nationalist Turkish bureaucracy and the judiciary, and in the media, as somehow having insulted Atatürk's memory and Turkish nationalism. In vain did, you know, so charges were brought, an indictment was drawn up, and Hrant began to be tried under the now notorious and infamous Article 301 of the Turkish Penal Code. Hmm. Now, this was a critical signal by the state apparatus to what we might describe as autonomous street nationalism or street vigilantism, that Hrant was fair game, in effect. That he was under charges of having insulted the Turkish nation, Turkicity, Turkishness, whatever very vague terms, and he was being tried on those counts, and all his court hearings became occasions for small but tough groups of nationalist vigilantes to gather and to yell slogans at him as he was walking into the courtroom, to throw things at him, to spit at him, and in general create a historical atmosphere of psychological terror. And so in vain did he try to explain, and in vain did others try to explain, that there was nothing, these articles were not even about Turkish nationalism, that he had been criticizing Armenian nationalism. But a witch hunt, newfangled McCarthyist kind of atmosphere was created, in which he became a prime target. What the official legal targeting and prosecution and persecution did was, as I've said, it signaled certain unknown groups of nationalist vigilantes out there that here was someone who could legitimately be targeted as the enemy within, the traitor in our midst, who is stabbing us in the back, and that he could be attacked with impunity. Of course, the broader context was that this was part of a much larger game, as has now become clear. It was, in fact, in some sense, it was actually a small plot in a much bigger gamble by the Atatürkist, militarist, statist nationalist establishment in Turkey to keep its legacy of hegemony over Turkish politics and to keep dissent and opposing political forces out of public space and politics. And it was in that context that ultimately there seems to have arisen this small group of ultra-nationalist vigilantes in the region of Trabzon on the Black Sea coast. This is a region notorious for its deeply entrenched ultra-nationalism because of legacy of the Pontus question from the days of World War I. This was a region in which there was a very sizable Greek Orthodox population, and there was a struggle between rival nationalisms and a kind of ethnic warfare at the ground level preceding the years and during World War I and thereafter, when the sizable Greek Orthodox population was ultimately exchanged away in 1923 as a result of the, or as part of the Lausanne-ordained population exchange between Greece and Turkey. But so this there seems to have arisen this small group of ultranationalist vigilantes who sent one of their members, a young man, underage, only 15 years old, knowing that, you know, he would be getting off relatively lightly because he was under 18 in terms of his legal responsibilities, to murder Franz. And I left, ironically, I left Turkey on the morning of 19th January this year, invited to teach for a month a mini course on Turkish nationalism at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. I flew from Istanbul to Detroit. I landed at Detroit in the afternoon, and I learned from the people who had who were welcoming me, who were in tears, strangely, that Hrant had been murdered while I was flying over the Atlantic.
Hmm. Certainly, many people in Turkey were outraged, and 100,000 people turned out for his funeral.
Some people estimated at closer to 200,000.
One of the questions I wondered, though, was, yes, there were a lot of people who were outraged. There was a great deal of anger. How many people, though, would have said something like, well, you know, you say things like that, you're that kind of a person, that's going to happen. I guess what I wonder is how many people would silently have said, well...
Many people did very vocally. I mean, in what Hrant's murder did was, in a sense, it could be... It was probably intended to be by the deep down, deep background planners or inciters... instigators behind it. Maybe it was intended to be something like the Reichstag fire in Germany in 1933. But, I mean, perhaps the intended Nazi-style takeover never happened. So it failed in that regard. This whole campaign ultimately failed in that regard. But in any case, it led to a profound cleavage in Turkish society and the media. While more than 100,000 people, including, well, I was in the United States, but I gather virtually my entire university and my colleagues, businessmen, academics, etc. And this was not, you know, just a relatively isolated, marginal kind of your typical kind of leftist protest. It became enormously mainstream. The very, very mainstream and prestigious Turkish Businessmen's and Industrialists Association of Istanbul played a major part in organizing it. And in the films and the footage of the funeral, you can see a very high number of well-known businessmen, bankers, that is to say, all the liberal democratic elements of the business class in Turkey marching in the front ranks. So it became a very unique phenomenon. But just as more than 100,000 people were to march, willing to march behind the slogan, "We are all Hrant Dink, we are all Armenians." And this was the fantastic thing about it. Hmm. At the same time, just as Hrant's murder appeared to have liberated Turkey's democratic, non-nationalist public opinion from its inhibitions about speaking out against this enormity, and also in terms of speaking out against Turkish nationalism, it also turned out that the murder had somehow liberated the ultranationalists, the quasi-fascists, whatever, from their inhibitions in terms of openly defending an act of this enormity, you know, a crime. And The press and the public opinion in Turkey were divided over this. To this day, there are many, many people still saying he got what was coming to him. He deserved it. And to the extent of many groups saying we true Turkish nationalists will never allow such anti-Turkish Armenian, pro-Armenian, pro-Greek voices, whatever, such treachery to be heard vocally in Turkey. So what happened was the murder highlighted the extent to which contemporary Turkey was passing through and is still passing through a Weimar-like crisis. It is a very finely balanced thing. And there are strong forces in Turkey that desire and would like to create a much more democratic Turkey, a much less military-controlled, a much less authoritarian kind of, a much more truly pluralistic and tolerant Turkish politics, including the breakdown of taboos that have been built into the making of the Turkish nation state, such as the long-standing taboo over the Armenian question, the long-standing taboo over the Kurdish question, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they would, in other words, like to see Turkey traveling further and further along the road of democratization and Europeanization. And there are also strong forces of conservatism or the status quo or of reaction who want to maintain Turkey in the grip of a relatively authoritarian statist nationalist political culture, who would like to maintain the guardianship, so to speak, of the military over political life, and who would like to maintain a non-accountable instead of internationally accountable kind of nation state. Of course, this is part of the larger picture. That is to say, we are living in an age of globalization, including globalization of ideas like universal human rights and the idea that nation states should be internationally accountable to some notion of universal public opinion and notions of world governance. This idea of accountability, international accountability, keeps coming up again and again in former Yugoslavia, regarding Myanmar right now, and numerous other examples. But for, of course, the Turkish military bureaucratic establishment that calls itself Atatürkist and sees itself as the real master, the real owner of the country, such increasing international accountability is anathema. And so the country has come to be increasingly politically divided between what I would call basically the Europeanists and the anti-Europeanists. I think this is the fundamental cleavage in Turkey. It is not between Islam and secularism, etc. Very ironically, the secularist Atatürkists have become increasingly anti-Western and anti-European, whereas Turkey presents the unique phenomenon of a country in which a very strong movement of moderate political Islam has emerged as the most pro-European force.
Yeah. This, I want to come to this, and first, if you will allow me, out for people who might just have tuned in, I'd like to reintroduce you, and then I want to talk a little bit about what has happened in politics this summer. Halil Baktay is our guest. He's an historian, associate professor of history at Sabancı University in Turkey. He's currently spending time at the Center for Middle East Studies at Harvard and is visiting here, sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. And we're talking about Turkey, Turkish politics, and Turkish nationalism. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Back this spring, people will recall, there was, and I believe this, it was in April, started in April, there was a wave of protest and political activism in Turkey. When the prime minister, Mr. Erdogan, nominated Abdullah Gül, his foreign minister, to be the president, and many people said, we don't think this is a bad idea because they felt that he was Islamist. His wife wears a headscarf. Much was made of that. And many people apparently said, if he becomes president, this would jeopardize the notion that Turkey is a secular society. So after a lot of protest, Mr. Erdogan apparently decided to force the issue and said, all right, we'll have an election. And amazingly enough, his party won a very significant victory. And eventually, after a couple of votes in the parliament, his choice, Mr. Gül, was put forward again and became the president. What happened there? And why was it that it seemed that initially there was this so much protest and these concerns about this secular religious divide that then seemed to turn around when at least something approaching half of the people who voted for the AKP, voted for the ruling party, Mr. Erdogan's party, and eventually his man became the president.
This actually did not start in 2006, 2007. Mm-hmm. It started way back in 2004. The newly created AKP, led by Mr. Erdogan and Mr. Gül, emerged as a movement of moderate political Islam, or perhaps even better, a conservative modernist party of some kind of moderate Islamic inspiration. It became the major center-right party in Turkey in the 2002 elections, when it virtually won two-thirds of parliament on the basis of 34%+ of the national vote. And then, very surprisingly, this Erdogan-Gül leadership over 2002, 2003, 2004 moved very radically, in a certain sense, to push through a series of democratization reforms on the track to full membership with the European Union. This is what I mean by, you know, a party of moderate Islam emerging as the strongest and the most vibrant pro-European, pro-Western force in Turkish politics. This led to an enormous realignment of forces in Turkish politics, forces and roles and positions in Turkish politics that is still going on. Faced with this pro-European drive, for example, the Republican People's Party, which has traditionally defined itself as social democratic, center-left, in favor of the West, in favor of human rights. I mean, the modernization and universalization agenda of the Kemalist revolution. It switched positions, in effect, under Mr. Deniz Baykal's leadership. It was faced with an option of whether to base its opposition to the AKP on along the lines of, you are not doing enough for democratization or Europeanization, and you are doing too much in the way of democratization and Europeanization. That is to say, you are selling out the country once more to Western imperialism. Mm. And ironically, the Republican People's Party opted for the second option. That is to say, from 2002, 2003 onwards, very heavily defeated in the elections, with only around one-third of parliament, on the basis of only 19% of the national vote, it decided to align itself with the military bureaucratic deep state, as we call it, and other nationalist and ultra-nationalist forces to launch a campaign predicated on the mentality that somehow the era of late 19th, early 20th century new imperialism was being repeated. Turkey, just like the late Ottoman Empire, was in danger of partitioning. The Sevres Treaty was about to be revived, and a secret Christian-Western conspiracy was still in force against modern Turkey, and that the party in power, the AKP, was selling out national interest in its quest to find a peaceful solution to the question of Cyprus, in its overtures of trying to find some kind of political solution to the Kurdish question, and so on and so forth. Increasingly, what happened was, this was not very noticeable at that time, but increasingly, there was arising a kind of conservative, reactionary bloc drawing together the military and the bureaucracy and the judiciary together with the Republican People's Party and also the quasi-fascist Nationalist Action Party. Increasingly, they started to campaign on the basis of isolationism or anti-Europeanism, anti-Westernism. The key issue, as I've said, being one of maintaining the non-accountability of the Turkish nation-state over questions of human rights, democracy, torture, the Kurdish question, and so on and so forth. I mean, what happened was the AKP, nevertheless, maintained enormous momentum. It was as if the opposition, this reactionary opposition that I'm trying to describe, was caught completely by surprise, and before they could get their act going, the AKP had proceeded very far in terms of Europeanization and democratization reforms, and it was able to win recognition by Europe in December 2004 that conditions were ripe for starting full membership negotiations with Turkey. The nationalist opposition to this got itself organized progressively in 2005 and 2006. That is to say, it was like a backlash. They were too late. They couldn't stop this democratization and pro-European drive, but they started throwing up a much stronger kind of opposition from early 2005 onwards. So it was not just the nomination of, I mean, presidential elections being due and Tayyip Erdogan nominating Abdullah Gül. It had started long before that. Now, secularism became the principal plank or platform of this nationalist campaign. I mean, the idea that the AKP had a secret agenda about overthrowing secularism and bringing back an Islamic state based on the Sharia, based on Islamic canon law, that they were just dissimulating and hiding their secret agenda until they had conquered all citadels of power. You know, this was the whole militaristic, authoritarian, nationalist campaign came to be basically predicated on this, on the secularism issue. I, by the way, totally disbelieve as a historian that there is any such secret agenda. I do not think that in the era of mass politics and mass communications, a mass political party like the AKP with 340, 50 deputies in parliament. This is not a, you know, a Nazi style or a old communist style cadre party that can maintain secrecy or anything like that. You know, there is no such thing. This is a phantasma. You know, this is a ghost that doesn't really exist. That does not have tangible substance to it. But in effect, they try to create a nationalist mass movement. They try to create a new public opinion over 2006-2007 around the question of secularism as a bulwark against this supposedly secret clandestine Islamic agenda. And in doing so, they positioned themselves, they portrayed themselves as the defenders of the Kemalist revolution and the legacy of Kemalism and especially secularism in Turkey. I have certain historical comparisons in my mind. Number one, Bismarck's Kulturkampf against the Catholic Church, against Catholicism, over the second half of the 19th century, when he was trying to fully establish the authority of the Prussian Junkers class and eliminate all alternative challenges to hegemony of political and ideological power in Germany. And further along line, secondly, Hitler's campaign against the Catholic Church, against Catholicism in Nazi Germany. This is the kind of secularism, a very intolerant and a very doctrinaire kind of fanaticism around secularism that we are talking about. And again, I would like to repeat that I perceive secularism not to have been the real issue, but something much bigger than that. It was a fig leaf for something else.
Let me, if you would allow me, because we're coming now to the point where we maybe have about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
And I realize that and I really appreciate the depth and the thoroughness with the way that you're talking with us. Just as perhaps one last thing to talk a little bit about. As you say, for some time now, discussions have been underway that would pave the way for the admission of Turkey to the EU, which is, and one thing we would have to acknowledge, this is quite a long process.
Yes.
It would take some time, and there are a number of difficult issues, at least as far as the Europeans are concerned, that would have to be resolved. Cyprus is one. There are concerns about the infamous Article 301. There are a number of concerns that Europeans have.
Incidentally, if I might come in, President Gül, I hear from the recent news that just yesterday he said clearly in public, the newly elected President Gül, that he is in favor of moves to abrogate Article 301.
Get rid of through. I was wondering about that too, because I know that there was some, in what I was reading, there was some suggestion that they might actually do that. That's one of the issues that some European countries, I think the French particularly, have a big issue with that. But you know, so there are a number of difficult things that would have to be dealt with. And I know that in Turkey, certainly, I think that there were a lot of people who were rather angered by the reaction of some Europeans to the admission of Turkey, because the Europeans said, well, Turkey, they're not Europeans. It's not a European country. Why should they be in the EU? And I think that some people in Turkey understandably took offense to that kind of position. Given that there's all this that's got to be worked out and it's very difficult, what do you think is the prospect long term that eventually that would actually happen, that Turkey really would join the EU?
Of course, there are enormous problems in Turkish politics and in Turkish society, and there are enormous politics in Europe. The latest phase of this post-communist era is, I think, coming to be characterized by a lack of visionary leadership in the West in many places, not to speak of the United States. But in Europe, for example, as represented by the rise of Sarkozy and Merkel to power in France and Germany, respectively, there are strong forces in European politics that think that Europe should remain as a kind of white man's Christian club, predicated on traditions going back to medieval Christendom, religio-cultural traditions going back to medieval Christendom. If you ask, for example, Polish Catholic nationalists, they would be likely to say Europe, in fact, should be preferably a purely Catholic club. I mean, there is that kind of very Catholic Polish nationalist. And what is interesting is, we have a saying in Turkish that says it takes two hands to make a clapping sound, which is the Turkish version of it takes two to make a fight. The interesting thing is the clandestine love affair, if you want, between Turkish anti-Europeanists and Europeans who are against Turkey's membership, because they need one another to maintain their respective exclusionary political positions. Mm-hmm. Turkish nationalists, anti-Europeanists, when they create judicial farces that they know will have very strong repercussions in Europe, they know what they are doing, and in fact they are to a large extent playing into this anti-Turkish backlash that will then ensue in Europe. That is to say, many people have noted this in Turkish politics over the last 2 years. To some extent, these two poles depend on each other for their existence and political credibility. So it's going to be a very tough course. But the crucial point is this. The metaphor of Ithaca from the Greek poet Konstantin Kavafis. It is not really ultimately becoming a member of the EU that matters so much as the journey. The journey is what is important. Mm-hmm. Because as long as the European ideal of a much more universalistic and humanistic widespread democracy and democratic norms is there, this will continue to exert a very, very motivating force on Turkish politics. That is the first aspect. That in trying to attain European admission, Turkish society, Turkish politics will be reforming and democratizing the country, and that's what really matters. The second aspect is that, which I think narrow-minded European politicians don't realize, there is the question of what Turkey would contribute to European democracy. I tend to think that a Europe that has come to admit and accept and internalize a country like Turkey, which is secular but of course which has a largely Islamic population, is bound to rethink its own democratic norms, including the question of its own laicism or secularism. That is to say, a Europe with Turkey rather than without Turkey is, I think, likely to be a much more multicultural, much more pluralistic, much more tolerant, and much more actually secular kind of society than a Europe without Turkey. Hmm. So there is this question of, you know, what Europe itself stands to gain from Turkey's membership that is not often realized, and that is not often discussed even in Turkey.
Well, as we say, that it's a long road, so I suppose one would better be able to answer the question if we were having this conversation in 4 or 5 years, maybe. Or perhaps you would say it wouldn't take that long.
I think that the next 3, 4, 5 years with the AKP now, once more, with nearly a two-thirds majority in parliament, by the way, what happened was all this authoritarian nationalist drive at trying to create an abnormally hysterical kind of public opinion, it backfired so considerably. In the last 22nd July elections, the mm-hmm. AKP raised its percentage of the popular vote from 34%+ to 47%. Yeah. About 12 percentile points, and this was what completely shocked, the anti-Europeanists and the isolationist bloc. But I think that now that they also have the presidency, and I think of Mr. Gül as the best in the AKP leadership, a much more intellectual and broader and flexible and tolerant man than Mr. Erdogan himself, the real intellectual in the AKP leadership, whom we now have for president, and I was and I am all in favor of his presidency. I think the next 3 or 4 years are going to be crucial. The key question will be whether and to what extent the AKP leadership will try to maintain, preserve, and protect the de facto alliance between itself and the liberal democratic intelligentsia that has been forged over the last 2 years.
We must stop. For people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Halil Baktai, he will be speaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock. He's visiting here the campus, a visit sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. And he'll be talking more about new nationalism and vigilantism in Turkey this afternoon at 4 o'clock, 126 Library and Information Science Building. That's on East Daniel. And I'm assuming anyone interested in hearing more from him should feel welcome to stop by. Our guest, Halil Baktai, is a professor of history at Sabancı University in Turkey. Now he is currently at the Center for Middle East Studies at Harvard. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.